Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 47th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, audiobooks to help us understand the world. On this episode, I was joined by Paul Bourne, author of the book Breakthrough Community Change, a guide to creating common agendas that change everything. Paul was a veteran community organiser, whose work has contributed to lowering cancer rates in Maine, improving mental health for young people in Florida, and reducing poverty rates in Canada by 20%. In this much-needed new book, he shares stories of how he was able to catalyse local communities and guide them to make significant progress on seemingly intractable community problems. Paul has found that the secret to success is to organise and unite around a common agenda. And this is not a list of topics like a meeting agenda nor a strategic plan. He offers a process for bringing leaders from businesses, human service organisations and governments together with people who have a lived experience of a specific community problem. It was great to discuss the book with him, and I hope you enjoy the episode. This is a field that you have deep experience in, and you've had much success in bringing about breakthrough community change. How did this become an area of interest to you in general?
Great question overall, because it's not a natural kind of understanding. What happened for me is that I was running a community economic development organization, and we wanted to bring about big change. So we just got bigger. And we ran programs to help people, you know, low-income people to start small businesses, thinking, oh, that's going to work. And we helped over 1,000 get started. We helped thousands and thousands of people get back to work, particularly during plant closures. We worked in all the low-income neighborhoods. And it was all, like, really successful. And we were getting all of this credit, including the United Nations, who came to us and gave us the top 40 organizations in the world award. And I remember that community was very proud, and Nicholas Yu flew in from Nairobi and was giving us this award at this big ceremony. And I was feeling so conflicted. And I went up to talk, and I said, Nick, you know, I find this really interesting that you're giving us this award today. Because, like, even though we've done all these things, right, and they've been successful, the reality, poverty went up by 5% in our community. So last I heard, if you're a corporate executive and you lose 5% of your shareholder wealth, right? Because I kind of looked at, if we get 5% more poor, our job was to end poverty, and we're making it, and it was getting worse. You usually get fired, not recognized. You know, and I said, so with all due respect, I don't think we should be accepting this award today. Right? Well, you can tell it didn't go over so well. But it was the beginning of my thinking. I was thinking, man, if you are going to be the best, right, at something, and you're still not winning, like you're still not making the world better like you hoped you were, and that's the problem. Like in so many areas, we run these great programs in communities, but things keep getting worse. So I wanted to ask this question. How do you change the system that is causing the problem? And the only idea I had at the time, if everyone in the community just changed 10%, what would that look like? If everyone changed 10%, how would we think differently about ending poverty? Well, people caught on to it. I raised a couple of million dollars very, very quickly, got the corporate sector involved, and we started to think about breakthrough ideas. How could we actually change the way our community showed up? And our goal was in 4 years to create the lowest level of poverty in our country, in our community. That was a radical thought back then, and we did it. And now we're in about 500 municipalities throughout Canada, the United States, and other parts of the world. And the book Breakthrough Community Change, it doesn't only tell the story. It actually is our opportunity to present the methodology that we teach to those 500 communities. And it's trying to make it really practical and straightforward about how you can make large-scale change, which we call population-level outcomes.
In regards to just breakthrough community change, you highlight early on the importance of effective collaboration. Why is this imperative, and what are good ways, would you say, to get this started?
Well, I mean, let's first of all just talk about what a breakthrough change is not, right? Like, so often we think that the breakthrough is going to come because of an invention, right? Oh, it's going to be a great idea. And then we're all going to follow that idea and boom, we're going to get the change that we want. Well, it might happen in computers and in technology, but it doesn't really happen very often in social change. It does sometimes, you know. Or the other one is, oh, it's out there. Someone else has an idea. What we need is experts to come and help us. Well, I don't know about you, but I mean, consultants seem to cause me more work, not less. And I'm not saying there aren't good ideas out there. And of course, we need to learn about them, right? And the last one is that it's not about like that we're not good enough or that we don't have enough resources or that we have to work harder. Right. All of those things. Breakthrough community change is really about uniting a community. You know, you just used the word collaborating. It's about working together. And almost every change that has ever happened, you know, even I'm a huge fan of Martin Luther King Jr., kind of a bit of a geek. And you often think, OK, MLK, he was the man. Right. He was the charismatic soul that changed everything. Well, the team behind MLK was probably as talented as he was, you know, and the thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people, right? So what we need to do is kind of begin to understand that if we want large-scale change, we need to have a systematic process of uniting people, engaging them, mobilizing them, and then creating a framework in which they can work together. And that's what the book describes, is that process and that framework. I wouldn't call it a step-by-step, but it is a guide to creating common agendas that create everything. So there's a real attempt to be practical, you know, and I lay out those steps for people to follow.
I like how you highlight in the book that the only way to bring about collective change in a community is to find a way in which works within that community's unique set of circumstances. Does this tie into the importance of engaging citizens in things that actually affect their lives as well, Paul?
It does. I mean, one of the things that's unique about our process is that we want to bring people together from the business community, from the government, from the voluntary sector, or what we call the community sector, and then people with lived and living experience. So what we say is that the people with lived and living experience are the people who are going to benefit the most if we're successful. So if we're trying to end poverty, it's people who are living in poverty. We need to involve them equally with all the other sectors. Now, if it's, let's say, climate change, I always say the people who are going to benefit the most from climate change are young people, right? Because they're the ones who are going to have to live with it for the longest. And they're the most idealistic in some ways about it. So what happens is that when we bring these four sectors, again, business, government, the voluntary sector, and people with lived and living experience, we try to bring them together in equal amounts. And in the first year, we spend a lot of time in conversation. So this is not a quick process. It's not just something, a paint by numbers that you do. We spend a whole year engaging people. And primarily the reason for engaging them is that they can, first of all, hear other people's opinions, let go of their own. Because it's interesting, you bring 100 people into a room, there's 100 different understandings of the problem and 100 different solutions, maybe more, right? So you need to somehow get people to listen to each other, let go of, we call it their mental model for a while, let go of their assurances of what it's going to take to solve the problem, and then come to some form of common understanding and common agreement. That process of letting go and coming into a common understanding and learning to think with other people, we call it strategic thinking, is the critical component. And of course, that comes back to your question, because it allows us then to get as close to the issue as possible, right? We call it gaining a corner on the obvious, right? We want to really understand what's going on. And it's not important that a researcher understands that. It's important that everyone that wants to see change has that common understanding and in a sense agrees on what we need to do. That's the common agenda. Then what we do is we begin to organize. We form a leadership team. Again, I like the leadership team to be three from each sector, three from business, three from government, three from the voluntary, three with lived experience. Then we create a listening team. And that listening team goes broadly out in the community, and maybe we'll hold 50 to 100 community conversations. Again, doing what we did with this group of 100, doing it with thousands. And it's amazing how that starts to build a momentum and all kinds of dialogue starts to happen in the community. Then we start to create action teams. And these action teams, what we call it in the early days, we call them quick win teams, where as we're listening, certain things start to happen, right? You know, I remember in this one case, we had, I think it was just over 5,000 people on the waiting list for affordable housing. And then when we did close research, we identified that there were 400 of them that were on the list. But if we just helped them a little bit, they could qualify for fair market housing rather than subsidized housing. And the team did it. They just put a thing together. They started working with landlords. And in just a couple of months, they got that many people housed in better housing. Right. So little things like that. We do, you know, cleanups of, you know, when we're doing environmental stuff, we might do cleanups of creeks and so forth. But just so that they're starting to get a sense of practicing working together, that's what these small action teams do. And all of this is happening at the same time. And about a year to 18 months after we start talking to people and bringing people together, it's quite a long time, we write a community plan together and we celebrate it. And we have this great meeting, and it's kind of, I don't know if you've ever been to a crusade, like I call them a Billy Graham crusade. You know, remember when you'd go up and people would be saved, right? Well, I'm sorry, it's not like that at all, but it's this sense that suddenly everyone's standing up. The United Way, we're on. Ellen Bradley, we're on. Walmart, we're on. And so everybody is showing their support for the plan, but not only support, that they're getting ready to implement it. And, you know, the energy in the room, if it's done right, is crazy. You know, and so people always say, oh, everyone's burnt out. Everybody's so tired. We don't experience that in this process. And sometimes people say to us, hey, you know, you're taking so long. And I'm going, yeah, but how long has it taken for this problem to get so bad? And the fact is, in the last 20 years, I've seen almost no progress on this issue. So if it's taking a little long, maybe that's what it takes for people to rethink. And we've had some amazing results. I mean, the city of St. John, New Brunswick, it was at 28% poverty. And now 20 years later, we've been working this way. We're down at 11%. That's a huge 28 to 11. You know, we're seeing the same kind of changes in the state of Maine. We wanted to tackle cancer. We wanted to look at bringing the cancer rates down by 20%. Didn't quite get there, but we did significantly. Again, just by getting people working together. And in a sense, in Maine, we moved the fight for cancer out of the hospital and onto the streets. And we got corporations to, do cancer screening days where all the employees could go get screened. We got well diggers and drillers to start putting filters onto all of the wells that they were digging so that we get some of the chemicals out of people's bodies. We created volunteer networks to make sure that people with cancer could get to their medical appointments. It's all that kind of stuff that starts to happen. But here is the kicker, and it's maybe the core of the book. We're changing the way we think about the issue. So, a breakthrough for us is when we start thinking about ending poverty rather than alleviating it. Our campaign is we want less poor, not better poor. So now we are looking for those breakthroughs. What are the ideas? What are the actions? How do we have to work together? And then we start asking questions like, okay, if we're at 14% poverty in our community, what would 11 look like? What would 9 look like? And that starts the creative ideas churning, but not just like fantasy. It starts to get very real. Okay, where do we start? Who do we help move down? And then we do it. It's been a remarkable effort. And, you know, last year, the World Economic Forum gave us the first global award on collective action, recognizing this methodology as being highly successful and working in many contexts around the world today. So again, that's what the book is documenting, the stories and the methodology.
I suppose it highlights once again the importance of setting an agenda, having an idea of change which will directly affect the people within the community that they can get behind. And then on top of that, to take a moment to recognize whether it's working or not and celebrate the wins or celebrate the progress that's also taken place as well.
It's definitely all of those steps. But I think what makes this somewhat different is that we're taking the time to think about those ideas that are going to result in population level changes. So it's not just about helping people to eat a little better today or to be a bit warmer or to have better housing. It's about asking, what are the fundamental problems that are causing people to live in poverty? What are the fundamental problems that are causing us to produce so many emissions and all the volume that we're creating to climate change? It's looking at some of those bigger problems and asking some of the bigger questions. And maybe a really practical one in answer to your question, I was working with a group in Singapore that was wanting to create the best experience in the world for migrant workers. Go figure. Okay. And Singapore has like just a ton of migrant workers, right? It's kind of what keeps the economy running. And during COVID, they kept them all in housing and away from the population because everybody was isolated. So they started thinking, what do we do here? Because people still needed to make somewhat of a living because there's lots of people back home depending on their income and all of that kind of stuff unfolding. And then they realized that there's all kinds of things that they could do that were going to improve the lives of migrant workers. Number one, just to figure out how do we make a better direct connection between the actual employer and the worker's family so that we don't end up having these middle people who often are the ones exploiting. So they have to figure out, okay, how do we do that? How do we create that direct system? With technology, it's quite possible, right? Number two, how do we create the kind of living conditions that promote health and well-being. Okay, well, how do we do that? Because all of these migrant workers are housed in these huge complexes. And so people started to work on that. They started to work on how do we get the money back to the families, because that's why migrant workers are coming, mostly to make money for their families back home. How do we do that in a way that there are very few fees taken from their money, because they're often exploited at that point too. And then, you know, how do we give them time off? And if they take time off, how can we give them enjoyment? Right? All the things that weren't thought of before. And then why do it? Well, because if you're the best place in the world for migrant workers, there's a huge competition for migrant workers. So it's great for the economy, but more importantly, it's great for the migrant workers because they don't have work back home. They can't make the living that they want to make. And maybe that's a whole nother systemic problem that we need to deal with. But I thought it was really interesting that they would use this process to look for, according to them, these were breakthroughs. No one had even actually thought of this kind of intervention. They were those people, right? And you don't think about them. And yet they're in front of you every day. And that's what kind of COVID helped them to see. So yeah, it's this methodology is being used around all kinds of issues.
Is it fair to say that these kind of breakthroughs and the ones that you mention in the book are ones which are more long-term focus as opposed to quick short-term wins?
I agree. Okay. In most of our communities, there's a lot of good work being done. I know in your neighborhood, in your country, all kinds of great work being done every day. Thousands of people helping, thousands of agencies doing good work. And for the most part, they're what I call transactional actions. They're making the lives of people in need a little bit better. Right? And that's a good thing. We can't stop doing that. We don't want to stop doing that. But we need to ask some bigger questions. In my book, I tell this favorite little story. I don't know if you grew up with this. The story of this little boy who comes to the shore. And there's all these starfish that have washed up on the beach. And he starts throwing them back in. Do you remember that story? It's like probably a Hallmark card or something, you know? And this man comes up to him and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm throwing the starfish back into the water." And he says, "Why? It's just a waste of time." And the little boy picks up one more starfish, throws it in the water. "Well, at least I helped this one." And then we're all supposed to go, "Oh, that's such great. You know, he helped at least one." And so nothing feels futile. Well, today, if I was that thinking and I'd rewrite that story, I'd say, first thing I would do is run to the nearest neighborhood, organize as many people as I could, bring them down to the beach so that we'd have a volume of people throwing starfish back in. Then what I'd do is I'd say, "Do any of you guys know anything about starfish? Okay, who knows something? Okay, let's all get in a boat together and let's go out to sea and figure out why these starfish are coming in. What's wrong? What's going on?" And then we'd form a plan and we'd organize everybody that wants to help and we'd start working at stopping the starfish from coming to the shore. So as admirable as it is of this little boy throwing the one starfish in, and we need to be doing those actions in our lives all the time, in reality, we've got to end poverty. It's not good for our community. At the end, we have to turn around climate change, or at least adapt to it as a community so that we can maintain a quality of life, right? We've got to deal with school shootings in America. We got to stop them. They can't keep happening. We got to stop gangs from controlling our neighborhoods. And how do we do that? Right? The solutions that we currently have in play are not ending. They're maintaining. And somehow we've become okay with that. In Canada, you cannot actually become a charity for ending poverty. You can only be a charity if you alleviate it. Interesting, huh? And so what our work is doing is it's beginning to say, okay, everybody keep doing good stuff, but you got to unite at a higher level and you need to be working together at a systemic level while you're doing that good stuff. Right? So that we can connect the dots, we can connect the people. You know, in the town of Hamilton, they had a vision of making Hamilton the best place to raise a child. Amazing thing that they did. They went from one of the highest levels of child poverty to the lowest 10%. And the kind of work they did, I remember, like, it inspired one form of organization. And in a month, they closed a homeless shelter. Didn't need it anymore. Right? So it's like going like, how do you do that? Well, they just, in a very short period of time, by talking to each other and working at an end goal solution, they were able to find a much better way forward than what they were doing. And you do that 100 times, 1,000 times, and suddenly you go from 18% poverty down to 11, down to 10, down to 9, to ending it. And that's where we want to work, in that space. In many ways, that's why these books have been so popular. It's my third book on this topic, and the last two have become bestsellers. I'm hoping this one will as well. And maybe that your listeners should know this, like, the book is not being released until April 11th. And NG already got the book on Audible, listened to it, and is interviewing me before the release date. So good on you.
Thanks, Paul. So the last thing I actually wanted to ask you is, with all the things you mentioned in the book, because I feel you highlighted such a good comprehensive guide on bringing about breakthrough community change, how transferable are these steps for politicians to implement? Or is it difficult to try and tackle the needs of a nation in comparison to that of a community?
Great question. Like, I'm working now with municipalities and teaching them how to, I have a group, a specific group that's working for the next few months together to learn how to do this as a municipal government. We've helped hundreds of municipal governments do this. I'm working with at least 3 national organizations. One is a government organization that is trying to figure out how to democratize medical health records so that you would have access to your own health records, and any doctor, if you were an emergency across the country, they would have access to your health records. So again, it's revolutionizing. Right now, that's not the case, right? This transfer of medical records. In terms of government themselves, government is only one player, and politicians are only one player. It doesn't work that way. Government cannot solve our problems. They are the other. But if government wants to solve our problem, they need to be part of the solution with business, with the community sector, and with the people. And my experience is, when you mobilize the people and the not-for-profit organizations, the charities, the governments, and the businesses, and you mobilize them toward a good social end, and you can unify them toward that end, that is how things change. We call it whole community change. No part of the community can change the community. The only group that can change the community is the community itself. So how do you bring the whole community together, agree on the change that you want, and then move forward? And before anyone that's listening thinks, oh, that is so Pollyanna, like, let's think about, is there any other way? Everybody wants the same thing. That's my experience. They want a safe place to live. Everyone that I talk to wants a safe place to live. They want opportunities for their children. And they want to be alive. That's why it's my third one. They just want to be happy, right? They want spaces to be pretty. They want people to care for them. They want to care for other people. And I've never met anyone that doesn't want those three things, you know? So we've already agreed, doesn't matter what our politics are, doesn't matter all the things we disagree on, doesn't matter how good or bad I am, at the end, those are the three things that I'm going to want in my life. So then there's a whole bunch of other things that we want. Okay, but if we can agree that the three things that we want the most, a safe place to live, opportunities for our children, and happiness, an opportunity at least for happiness and the surrounding, then we got a beautiful foundation to build on. And one of the great moments in my life is when I go in the United States And it's just so polarized there. It's just so polarized. The left, the right, you know, it's crazy. And I remember in Des Moines, Iowa, we spent a day and a half together in a group so diverse. The richest people, literally the richest people in the community, and the poorest people in a room for a day and a half. And at the end of the day, when they were just sort of wrapping up, the whole room had so much energy. They just all stood up in a standing ovation. Not of me, of themselves, right? Of what they had accomplished in that day and a half. And they just said over and over again, we've never experienced anything like this. And all they did was talk. Well, maybe the crucial thing is they actually listened to each other. And we created the conditions for that to occur. It's an amazing world, huh? And there's an amazing energy. And we got to tap into it. We got to figure that out. We got to stop thinking that everything's broken. Because most everything isn't broken in most places. Sometimes it is. And we got to start thinking about all that we have going for us. And when we mobilize that toward the problems are not as overwhelming as they seem.
That was Paul Bourne, author of the book Breakthrough Community Change, a guide to creating common agendas that change everything. The physical copy of the book will be available on the 11th of April, and the audiobook is available now on Audible. A big thank you to Paul for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate the podcast, and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.